Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the speech in New Hampshire today by President Trump outlining his plans to deal with the opioid crisis, in which he called for his border wall and the death penalty for drug traffickers. Sam Quinones, a former Los Angeles Times reporter who spent 10 years as a freelance writer in Mexico and is the author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, joins us to discuss Trump's use of a medical and social crisis that cost the lives of 64,000 Americans in 2016 as a political platform to call the Democrats out for their opposition to his border wall, claiming that, quote, 90% of the heroin in America comes from our southern border, where eventually the Democrats will agree with us to build a wall to keep the damn drugs out. With Big Pharma largely responsible for creating the opioid crisis, in particular Purdue Pharma, which spent hundreds of millions promoting their prescription drugs OxyContin, from which they reaped tens of billions in profits. We will assess whether Trump's get-tough approach on heroin dealers makes any sense when the source of the problem is prescription drugs. Then we'll speak with Dr. Richard Reddick, an award-winning professor of educational leadership and policy with an appointment in the Department of African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas in Austin, to discuss the extent to which the city of Austin is gripped in fear after four bombings in mostly minority neighborhoods of Austin from a serial bomber who appears to have sophisticated training in explosives. We'll examine the possibility of the bomber having a racist agenda and the racial divide in Austin between the city's east side and west side. Then finally, with the UK government seeking a warrant to inspect Cambridge Analytica's databases, we'll look into the role of the political data analytics firm in influencing the Brexit vote and the US election now that Facebook has suspended the company, along with a Russian professor who got data from Facebook for Cambridge Analytica, Alexander Kogan. Mark Rotenberg, the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C., who teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center, joins us to discuss the damning information, thanks to a whistleblower, Christopher Wiley, that is pouring out of the secretive company advised by Stephen Bannon and funded by Robert Mercer. And joining us now is Sam Quinones, who's a former Los Angeles Times reporter whose career as a journalist has spanned more than 30 years. He lived for 10 years as a freelance writer in Mexico and is the author of True Tales from Another Mexico, The Lynch Mob, The Popsicle King, Chalino and the Bronx, and Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration. Currently, he's a freelance journalist writing for National Geographic, The New York Times, and The Los Angeles Times Magazine. And his most recent book is Dreamland, A True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Quinones.
Thanks for having me, man.
Well, thank you, Sam. And what did you make of the president's announcement today of how he's going to handle the opiate crisis?
Well, some of the things were welcome, I would say. You know, I think there needs to be a greater expanded focus on treatment and medically assisted treatment at that. The problem I think that I saw with this speech was that it focused on the thing about this issue is it is really one of the few issues in America that can bridge this poisonous polarization that so is corroding our national culture, our civic discourse, and so on. And this epidemic, I have found in my travels around the country, really brings together people from all walks of life, very different people with very different political views, brings them together. It's a catastrophe of national proportions, but it's also an opportunity. And I thought that a lot of what he was talking about today, death penalty for traffickers, sanctuary cities, et cetera, the whole several things, added that Washington partisan poison to the mix. And I thought that was overall especially unfortunate. I thought his focus on getting tough was you know, there most definitely is a role for law enforcement in fighting this scourge. It should not be a replication of the drug war, though, which is basically law enforcement was all we used. But there is definitely a role for law enforcement. This was, you know, a guy who's never been in the military, who's really never been tough himself, you know, surrounding himself with cops and prosecutors and so on. And so that left me a little miffed as well. And then, of course, the focus on the death penalty, to me, that felt like more of what got us into this problem in the first place. What got us into this problem in the first place was our desire to have an easy answer for a complicated problem. The complicated problem was the mystery of human pain. The easy answer that we were demanding as a culture and that pharmaceutical companies picked up on and began to provide for us and doctors kind of went along with was pills for everybody. Everybody gets fixed. No risk. You know, it was like a thing where nothing, that we had no bad consequences. We could have our pain fixed and there'd be no risk of addiction suddenly. It was the idea. And of course, it did work out very, very poorly, and we're living with the nightmarish consequences right now. And so the idea that there's going to be it feels like, okay, this is our big answer, death penalty for traffickers, feels to me like a little bit of that, like we've got the answer and this is going to take care of it, when in reality, the way we deal with this problem is by Americans coming together in a very unified way in community after small community after small community, after suburb after suburb, and working together and finding common ground, finding community that we've done so much to destroy in this country. And to me, that added this kind of partisan nastiness again that didn't need to be there. And this epidemic or this issue has largely avoided. And of course, you know, half facetiously, when I first heard of this idea, I thought to myself, well, is he referring to drug company executives, or is he referring to doctors? Because, of course, this is unlike any other drug scourge in modern America in that it did not start with mafias and street dealers and street peddlers and the classic thing like that. It started from pharmaceutical companies convincing doctors, pushing doctors to prescribe these pills massively, excessively from coast to coast, achieving a change in prescribing and culture in America in a very short period of time, really a decade was all it took. And you know, this is not your classic. So it was unclear to me right from the start which traffickers or which group he was referring to.
Yeah, well, it seems like he was talking about getting tough with the heroin dealers and putting up the border fence and going after the street dealers and not going after the dealers in the boardrooms of Purdue Pharma.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, of course, when I got time to think of it, that's why I realized he was referring to. This was a few days ago, of course. But it does leave the question, which dealers are you referring to? In this issue, I would also say it's very complicated. It's not so easy to say that person is a dealer, that person's a trafficker, and that person's an addict. With heroin, it all tends to mix and mesh and becomes very cloudy and opaque. I have met people who were longtime addicts, very desperately strung out, who then became major traffickers or you know, muling drugs from, say, Denver to Columbus, Ohio, in one guy's case, for example. It's not always clear who the dealer is and who the addict is and that they are somehow different. Most addicts end up dealing, and some of them end up dealing in what I would consider to be trafficker-level quantities. So it gets very, very, very cloudy, and when you get into these kinds of questions, when you're talking about this issue in particular, and then the other, of course, is the wall, which of course he has mentioned and made a campaign promise of, and so on. The problem with a wall in this case is that first of all, we already have walls along the board. I go down to Tijuana a fair amount. And in Tijuana, San Diego, there are two walls. One, the oldest one along the whole border it was in Tijuana, started in 94, built in 94, starts in the ocean and runs for 14 miles, broken only by the legal crossings, and stops at a mountain. Then there's another wall about 100 yards in that runs 3 or 4 miles, I think it is. But the problem with this issue is that all that walls do stop immigrants. They do. They've done a very effective job, in fact, of stopping immigrants at the San Diego-Tijuana border, for example. But they don't stop drugs, and particularly they do not stop heroin, and certainly they do not stop fentanyl. Heroin is the easiest drug of the illegal drugs to smuggle because it's so condensable. You can smuggle a very large amount of drugs in a backpack. And you have lots and lots of people now who have awakened in Mexico to this possibility and are now trafficking small amounts. You can make a lot of money trafficking 2 or 3 kilos at a time, and a lot of people are doing that. So these drugs are already coming through areas that have walls. So yet another wall. It's unclear to me how that would stop heroin, and certainly would not stop fentanyl, which is oftentimes come through the mail. A little sugar packet like at Denny's that you see, if that was filled with fentanyl, would kill everybody in, you know, a 5 mile radius of your radio station, you know. So that kind of thing is the problem with a wall is that it corrodes, in my opinion, it corrodes the one thing that really will stop heroin from coming. And that is a deep, prolonged, deep, consistent relationship with Mexico, in which we together as two countries deal with this issue. But of course the wall has tended to repel Mexicans and corrode the potential for that kind of relationship.
And again, I'm speaking with Sam Quinones, who's a former Los Angeles Times reporter whose career as a journalist has spanned almost 30 years. And he lived for 10 years as a freelance writer in Mexico. And his most recent book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Well, of course, never throughout the entire history of drug interdiction and the war on drugs have we ever stopped to ask the question, why do people take drugs in the first place? We've always had this sort of militaristic idea that we can stamp out the problem physically, if you will, rather than psychologically. And there's no question that what happened today with the president's speech in New Hampshire, where he hinted about running again for president, as you were mentioning, that this is a great bipartisan opportunity to bring America together over a shared problem. But today's speech was highly partisan. And of course, he blamed the Democrats. But to the point that I'm making, Sam, this is clearly a case where a drug company created an addiction problem that, when they had to withdraw this excessive amount of drugs from the market, people were forced to turn to heroin. And that, of course, was not something that Trump was concentrating on in his get tough approach today. But why is it that we never want to address the reasons why people take drugs in the first place, much of which, I believe, are sociological, if not political?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I would suspect it's because it's a very complicated question and it varies from person to person. It's true that humankind has always taken drugs of one form or another, nicotine, alcohol, what have you. I'm not sure as a country, basic public policy decisions lend themselves to that kind of discussion, maybe. I don't know. I'm not sure. It's not something I have pondered, honestly, about why we haven't had that conversation. I think we do at times. It doesn't leave us with any grand conclusions, I suppose. I don't know.
Well, the get tough part there, which is what was emphasized today, and I'll just give you a couple of quotes. Trump said, if we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty. And again, this is about winning a very, very tough problem. And if we don't get very tough on these dealers, it's not going to happen, folks. So tough, 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 tough. Yeah. Again, this is the opportunity here, I would think, is that we're talking about, you know, white middle-class communities that are afflicted. 64,000 people died of overdoses in 2016. So, you know, to reduce it down to the sort of street level, I'm not sure he mentioned MS-13, but he's obsessed with MS-13 as well. The idea that all of our problems result from a bunch of brown people peddling drugs when it's a bunch of white people in boardrooms that created this opiate crisis in the first place.
Yeah, I was fairly disappointed, let's say, to hear this raised again, because the truth is, on the ground in America today, there are many, many, many groups, grassroots, community, county level groups that are forming or have formed and have been working at this for a long time. They are working very hard, often without thanks, often without recognition. I was hoping for some of that. I was hoping that he would say, and I'm going to take a 12-state tour and go down at the grassroots level and find out what these local groups that have formed in county after county. I've seen them, many, many of these groups now that are forming and that are beginning to work together, not caring about whether anyone is conservative or liberal or Republican or Democrat, bringing people together in a very, very sweet and beautiful, beautiful way. And what they most need, well, they need funding, of course. That's probably what they most need. But they also need encouragement. They need the energy to say, yeah, let's go. We can do this, you know. And there was none of that. On the contrary, the death penalty, adding the death penalty into the mix is, and then you mix this whole issue up with the politics of capital punishment. And to me, that's what this does not need. It's hard enough issue to deal with as it is. What it really needs is like inspiration, people with vision, you know, getting out there and recognizing all those people that I've seen in places like Lycoming County, Pennsylvania, and various places in Ohio and in Kentucky and in Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, various places like that. These are places where people have like put behind all the construct that people in Washington seem to live for, which is the bickering and the bitterness of partisan divide. They put that behind them because they're dealing with life and death issues. And because they know each other, they know the kid who just died the other day. And they go to church with his family, or the family runs a local business. Everybody knows each other. And this is what's happening out in the country right now. And I was expecting, hoping, still hoping, that the president would go out and encourage those people. They are working hard. Sometimes they don't see much result. They just are doing what they think they can do. It's messy. Sometimes it doesn't work very well. Sometimes what they're trying needs improvement. But what is beautiful about it is you are seeing these communities that have been devastated many times coming together. It's a kind of a Pollyannish kind of thing, perhaps, to say. But I believe that is the way forward on this. That is, we need to foment that kind of activity, that kind of coming together in a community. And the thing today didn't seem to me to do that. That's I guess overall what bothered me about the thing. There were some good things I heard, but that's what really bothered me most. This is an opportunity. It's a national catastrophe that is also a wondrous opportunity to turn away from this corrosive isolation that has afflicted American culture for decades now, and really begin to use this horrible catastrophe as something positive, and it didn't happen.
Well, Sam Kendionis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Anytime.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Sam Kendionis, who's a former Los Angeles Times reporter. His career as a journalist has spanned almost 30 years. He lived for 10 years as a freelance writer in Mexico. and is the author of True Tales from Another Mexico, The Lynch Mob, The Popsicle Kings, Chelino, and The Bronx. And his latest book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the fear that has gripped the city of Austin, Texas, after four bombings in mostly minority neighborhoods.
Can I have some more? Oh, the damage done. I hit the city and I lost my band. I watched the needle take another man. Gone, gone, the damage done.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Richard Reddick, who's a professor in education, leadership, and policy at the University of Texas, Austin, where he also has an appointment in the Department of African and African Diaspora Studies and the Warfield Center of African and African American Studies. He previously served on the steering committee as an education working group co-chair of the Mayor's Task Force on Institutional Racism and Structural Inequality for the City of Austin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Richard Reddick.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be here.
And Richard, there have been four bombings in Austin, Texas. Clearly, the city is gripped by fear. The latest explosion, and most of these early attacks have been in minority neighborhoods, but the latest explosion on Sunday night, which injured two white men aged 22 and 23, was activated, that police believe, by a tripwire. And that took place in Travis County on the western, more affluent side of the city, whereas I believe the earlier bombings had taken place on the east side of the city. So do you have a divide there between east and west, black and white, in Austin?
Well, Ian, yeah, that's historically true. So in 1928, the city of Austin actually decreed a plan, and it basically moved African-Americans to the East Austin. If they wanted services, schooling, and so forth, they had to move from other parts of Austin. So parts of Austin that people are familiar with Austin at all, like Waitsville or Clarksville, or parts of the city that are now known to be, you know, sort of the most prominent areas of the city, were actually freedmen settlements in Austin's early history, and they were moved to the east side of the city. And a little bit later, the covenants, you look at the city, the restrictive covenants that were used, originally used language that talked about people of African descent, but then it switched to people of European descent only, which indicated that also Latinos, Mexican Americans, could not live in other parts of Austin besides East Austin. So the Austin I grew up in the 1980s and 1990s had pretty strong segregation in East Austin. Now, what's happened in the last probably 15 to 20 years is gentrification. So a lot of parts of Austin that were historically African American or Latino are now been gentrified, and they're mostly white. So yeah, so historically there has been a divide, and one of the challenging things about Austin's history is that it's not often talked about. And Austin is probably a lot like L.A. There are a lot of people who move here from other places and don't know the history. So people often wonder, well, why are certain parts of the city, you know, maybe not served as well by public transportation? Why is there, for instance, I went to high school right next to a tank farm where, you know, they had all kinds of interesting chemicals sitting in tanks. And that was removed in probably the mid-1990s. But yeah, so there has been historically this divide, which is along the Interstate 35, which goes to the city, East Austin being for African-Americans and Latinos, and West Austin being for whites. That is changing, especially in the Near East Austin part, but there's still a pretty strong indication and sort of separation of races, despite that fact.
So in terms of the bombing, it's the first bomb was last Monday, March the 2nd. It killed Anthony Stephen House, 29 at his home. He's an African-American man. And then Draylen William Mason, 17, was killed when he brought a package inside his home, and the explosion also critically injured his mother, another African-American, both. And then hours later, a 75-year-old Hispanic woman was injured by another package. And then I mentioned, of course, the two white men on the west side injured by the latest bomb. Initially, I understand the police thought there was a racial or a racist motive involved here. Has that changed now because of the latest bombing?
Well, it's interesting, Ian, because you're right in saying that the particular part of the city where the last bombing took place is fairly affluent. It's about 76% white. So it's a very different part of the city. And so that's definitely, I guess, perhaps changed some of the perspectives about what might be causing it. I don't think it diminishes the fact that there is a real fear of racial violence in the city, and that there's certainly been shockwaves in the community. I can tell you that both Mr. House and Mr. Mason were members of families that are quite prominent in the civil rights affairs of Austin. So that was a connection that people made fairly quickly, and is still a concern. And just the fact that those three communities are communities that are primarily African American or Latino is a concern as well. So this latest incident, and thankfully the men who were involved were not, I don't believe they were seriously injured. So that's something that's changed the analysis, I suppose, but it doesn't diminish the fact that the least for the first three bombings, there does seem at least to be some possibility that there was a racial component to it.
Well, there seems to be at least an agreement that the bomber or bombers are pretty sophisticated and perhaps have military training. Is that your understanding?
I haven't heard the part about military training. I have heard that they do believe that this last bomb especially shows some sophistication and some knowledge of bomb-making techniques. The news is kind of fast and furious here, but I haven't heard that yet, so that's interesting to know.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Reddick, who's a professor in educational leadership and policy at the University of Texas, Austin, who's had an appointment also with the Department of African and African Diaspora Studies and the Warfield Center for African and African American Studies. He previously served on the steering committee as an education working group co-chair of the Mayor's Task Force on Institutional Racism and Structural Inequality for the City of Austin. And you mentioned that the first two victims came from prominent African-American families involved in political activities and that the city of Austin, divided as it is, could have some kind of racial eruption. Are these bombings making that more likely? Is that perhaps the motive here? Are people on edge not just because they think they can be blown up at any moment, but on edge because they feel that there's a sort of racist out there blowing up African-American community leaders?
Yeah, well, Ian, well, one thing that I've talked about with some of my colleagues is just the fact that, you know, there has been a history and there has been sort of episodes of racial violence in Austin. People often think of Austin as being a very liberal oasis in utopia, and I can tell you, growing up in the city myself, I can certainly sort of raise some contrary perspectives towards that. And, you know, whether it is environmental racism or whether it's a situation like actual physical violence, like a bombing or police brutality, there are several incidences in Austin's history where people of color have felt less than safe in the community. So it's certainly, I think, heightened people's fears and concerns, but it does sort of lead into this larger picture of sort of the experiences of people of color in the city of Austin and how radically they differ from white citizens in Austin. And it's something that the city, through the mayor's task force, I think, is starting to become more able to discuss, but certainly something that a lot of folks either are unaware of or don't want to discuss. But it's really an issue for communities of color, especially Latinos and African Americans, because, as I said, whether it's policing, whether it's physical violence, whether it's disparate treatment economically and politically, these are longstanding concerns in our community.
Well, it would seem that political climate at the moment, where the President of the United States is spending a lot of time trashing the FBI, its leadership, its previous leadership, etc., and the city of Austin is now, you know, being inundated with federal officers, FBI, ATF, etc. It's a little ironic, isn't it, that at the moment where federal law enforcement is being trashed by our own president, in the city of Austin, they're kind of counting on them for help, aren't they, the local police?
Yeah, you raise a really interesting point. One of the more disturbing aspects of this administration is that since November of 2016, there's been an increase in hate crimes across the country. And so certainly it comes from the very sort of minuscule, microaggressive sort of things where people are sort of sensing there's problems to people actually being verbally or physically assaulted to events like this, if this is indeed a hate crime. So there is a lot of dependence and need for us to sort of consult with folks in the law enforcement community. And oddly, like you said, it's a community that typically has not been trusted or embraced by people of color for obvious reasons. But now, you're right, we have a chief executive who is using the platform to denigrate the folks who are actually in the front lines trying to assist and find out what's happening. I know we have profilers and the sorts here working on this case, and I know people in Austin are very grateful for that. And it is unfortunate that the leader of this country is not able to restrain himself and sort of stay to the issues at hand, which is we're greatly dependent on people in the FBI and other agencies like that to sort of get to the bottom of these kinds of issues.
And just personally, how's it affecting you, your family? I take it that everybody's being urged not to go anywhere near a parcel or a package or anything that's left standing that might be suspicious. How's it affecting you personally?
Yeah, I think that's a really key point. As I said this morning, I was talking with some colleagues, and we were all sort of talking about how nerve-wracking it is because one thing you did not necessarily know about, right now, Austin is just getting over the South by Southwest Music and Film Festival, which ended, I guess, Sunday. And there was a bomb threat, which I believe was not connected. They verified that it's not connected on Saturday night for one of the shows that featured the Roots. So there's, you know, this is, you know, like you said, tension, concern, and obviously the bomb maker has become more sophisticated in technique. So previously it was like, okay, stay away from unmarked boxes. Don't, you know, pick up boxes at your door. And now it's more even, you know, backpacks, large objects, you know, just sort of leave them alone. And obviously in a city our size, there's things like that are present all the time. So there is certainly, I think, a heightened level of concern. And, you know, having so many people in the city recently, you know, one wonders if there's some connection with that particular incident. But, you know, it's sort of this aspect of vigilance, especially in this time where I think political tensions are so fraught. It certainly seems to me that's something that people are on edge about. And so today, the first day back after spring break, it was kind of a topic of conversation everywhere. And of course, some people are returning from out of town and might have caught wind of the first bombing, but hadn't heard about the successive ones. And so I've had people in the Philippines and in other parts of the country, in Vermont, reaching out, Boston, saying, I heard what's happening in Austin, are you okay? And so it's always good to have folks across the country concerned about us. But, yeah, it certainly has sort of heightened tensions across the city, and I think everybody's sort of on edge and just hoping that the police, the federal agents who are involved in the investigation, and of course anybody in the community who actually knows something will come forward soon to sort of lessen our fears.
But you're an African-American man, and I take it, do you live in an African-American part on the east side?
I don't, actually. I grew up in southeast Austin, which is predominantly Latino. Right. And I went to school at Deep East Austin, but I live now in another part of the city. So not so much close to this. But astonishingly enough, the very first bombing wasn't that far from where I live. So in a lot of ways, we are separated in communities and in enclaves, but there are certainly not a lot of distance between the city. The city, I think, the bombing range has been about 26 miles or something like that. So, yeah, because we're a small community, as I said earlier, a lot of us are connected to members of the families affected by the bombing. So it is something that I think everybody is sort of concerned about. And you're right, as an African American, I am concerned about what could and would happen. That's something that we live with, you know, besides the usual sort of concerns about how we interact with law enforcement. The emboldenment of white supremacists in the last, you know, several months. Our university campus, you know, we've actually noted that we've had more and more sort of activity from some of those groups, posters posted and so on and so forth. So it's certainly something that people are keeping an eye on.
And today, three members of the Congressional Black Caucus called for federal officials to classify the bombings as terrorist attacks and determine whether they are ideologically or racially motivated. So we'll keep an eye on that, I guess. And in the meantime, I wish you all the best and your fellow citizens of Austin, Texas, Dr. Richard Reddick.
Thank you, Ian, and thank you for those good wishes.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Richard Reddick, who's a professor in education leadership and policy at the University of Texas in Austin, who has an appointment in the Department of African and African Diaspora Studies and the Warfield Center of African and African American Studies. He previously served on the steering committee and as educational working group co-chair of the Mayor's Task Force on Institutional Racism and Structural Inequality in the city of Austin. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the role of the political data analytics firm Cambridge Analytica, which the UK government is seeking a warrant to inspect its databases. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mark Rotenberg, who's the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University's Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. He has served on several national and international advisory panels, including the expert panels on cryptography, policy, and computer security for the OECD and legal experts on cyberspace law for UNESCO, and he chairs the ABA Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Rotenberg.
Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you, Mark. And we've heard a lot about Cambridge Analytica since the elections, their involvement in the Brexit vote. But now there's some clarity coming in about how important their role was and exactly what they did in perhaps influencing the elections, particularly in those three key swing states here in the U.S., Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, since they apparently got to 50 million Facebook profiles, which Cambridge Analytica harvested. And now Facebook has suspended them, along with a Russian professor, Alexander Kogan, who apparently got this information under the auspices of being an academic, when in fact it was used for political and arguably commercial purposes. So how significant is this banning, if you will, of Cambridge Analytica by Facebook?
Well, the banning is significant, of course, but far more significant is the disclosure by Facebook that the release of the user data may have influenced the outcome of the 2016 presidential election, which I think would come as a surprise to many Facebook users who had no idea that their personal data would be obtained or used in this way. And that's obviously the focus now of the debate in Washington and what I think will likely be a series of hearings in Congress to better understand the relationship between the data practices of firms such as Facebook and the decisions in Democratic elections.
Well, the fact that Stephen Bannon, who was the second campaign manager for Donald Trump, was on the board of Cambridge Analytica, and the company was funded by Robert Mercer, who was the biggest donor to Donald Trump, certainly is more than a coincidence.
Well, it is, and at the same time, in fairness, we should note that all political campaigns have made use of personal data in the past, so I don't think this should necessarily be viewed as a partisan issue. But what's of particular concern here is the way that Facebook data was used, amplified, and gathered in circumstances that users had no awareness that this would take place, and in our opinion, in violation of a legal order that Facebook was subject to with the Federal Trade Commission. In fact, I want to talk about that matter because that's been the focus of much of Epic's work almost this past decade, the importance of ensuring the protection of personal data by companies such as Facebook and the role that federal agencies such as the FTC play in ensuring that those protections are enforced.
Well, certainly, I want to talk to you about that, Mark. But in terms of the exploding headlines, if you will, coming from the New York Times, Guardian, and The Observer, and Channel 4 in the UK, Channel 4 is running a series of documentary investigations into Cambridge Analytica and its CEO, Alexander Nix, who appears to be in a great deal of trouble. Apparently, they had a secret camera on him advising clients how he could arrange for Ukrainian, good-looking Ukrainian women to compromise political candidates.
Well, okay, I don't know anything about that. Our focus, of course, concerns the collection and use of personal data by firms such as Facebook. And I think the key point here is that Facebook, in collecting this data from its users, has a basic responsibility to protect the information and to use it for purposes consistent with those with which users provided it. I would say that for any company anywhere that's collecting data about customers. And we understand that's the basic bargain. To obtain a service, you provide some information, and that makes it possible, you know, an email address or whatever it may be, to receive the service. Of course, what Facebook did was something very different, which was to gather up the data, make it available to this researcher, who makes it available for, election targeting. And it's not only the data, it's not only the users who were sort of misled into believing that by using one of these online games, they would have the experience of a game. In fact, their data was being captured and used for another purpose. But so too was the data of their friends, because when Facebook captures user information and makes it available to a business, part of the bargain that Facebook offers, unbeknownst to users at the time, was that it's also the data of the user's friends that are disclosed to the business. So all of this, is very deceptive. It's very misleading. It's very unfair to users. And it was all subject to a legal order that we had helped establish with the Federal Trade Commission back in 2012, which was supposed to prevent precisely this type of activity from occurring, you see. So this is why EPIC, my organization, has a very strong interest in the debate right now over how the data was used by Cambridge Analytica. This should have never happened. Facebook should not have been permitted to collect and disclose information this way, and the Federal Trade Commission should have exercised its authority under its consent order to block the disclosure of the personal data.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Rotenberg, who's the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University's Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. He served on several national and international advisory panels, including the expert panels on cryptography policy and computer security for the OECD, the legal experts on cyberspace law for UNESCO, and he chairs the ABA Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. Well, it seems, though, Mark, that we're learning about this because of a whistleblower on the inside, Christopher Wiley, who worked at a very high level for Cambridge Analytica, both during the Brexit period and also during the U.S. election period. So he's apparently been featured quite a bit in articles both in The Observer and The New York Times and in the UK Channel 4 series that I mentioned that's revealing all kinds of other salacious details. What's your understanding about Christopher Wiley? He seems like a pretty solid source, isn't he?
Well, so far what I've seen, the disclosures are reliable, but of course you want to see some, you know, documentation. It will be important to see precisely what data was obtained and how it was used, and if it's possible even to get, you know, screenshots revealing what users saw as a consequence of this profiling activity, that would be helpful as well. I mean, we can set the clock back a little bit in Washington and keep in mind, of course, that Congress has been after the internet companies to reveal more details about how profiling and targeting through the online networks took place during the 2016 presidential election. At the beginning, Facebook was very closed-lipped about this. They said, oh, it wasn't a big deal. It was a small ad buy. They weren't even sure who was purchasing the ads, and it seemed almost insignificant. And they didn't, frankly, want to cooperate with the Congressional Oversight Committees, which was remarkable because this included, of course, the Senate Intelligence Committee and other congressional committees that are very much tied to the protection of national security, trying to understand whether a foreign adversary had exploited the social networking platforms to change the outcome of the U.S. presidential election. So this is, in a sense, the latest chapter in a story. But at the same time, what's most remarkable now is the very significant privacy dimension that's been implicated by the use of Facebook user data in this way, and more precisely the disclosure, which, as I continue to contend, should never have occurred. The Federal Trade Commission simply should not have allowed this to happen. And if I'm right about that, it could be that their failure to act contributed to the outcome of the past election.
And, of course, along with banning or suspending Cambridge Analytica, Facebook also suspended this Russian academic, Alexander Kogan. He apparently got this data under false pretenses, asking, because apparently Facebook allowed academic research to use this data. But then, of course, he then turned it over to Alexander Nix to use it for political ends.
Yes, but let's even just stop at the outset and ask the question, who gave Facebook authority to disclose personally identifiable information to researchers? There are a lot of techniques in the research world that make possible analysis of aggregate data that don't require the disclosure of data that's personally identifiable. And anybody, any researcher who obtained access to such data would take on an enormous responsibility. I'm frankly surprised that Facebook, you know, allowed that to happen. It's not a best practice in the research field, and of course now we see the consequences. So this is the type of activity that, you know, once is uncovered, I mean, you know, the sanctions on the person who broke an agreement are almost meaningless. Obviously, they need to change their practices so nothing similar would happen in the future. And the data that was wrongly disclosed most certainly needs to be destroyed. I mean, that's the other issue that arises oftentimes in these circumstances. It's not simply enough to, you know, fire somebody or fine somebody. You actually need to track down the data and make sure that it will not be used impermissibly in the future.
Well, apparently the whistleblower Wiley, who, by the way, Christopher Wiley, he's apparently spoken to U.S. and U.K. authorities, and I believe the Mueller inquiry as well. He apparently has shown them a letter from Facebook's lawyers sent to him in August of 2016 asking him to destroy any data he held that had been collected by the holding company, GSR, of Cambridge Analytica. So that's a bit like the horse is already down the paddock, right? The barn door's open.
I mean, Yes, I mean, of course that's true. But you see, the burden still falls on Facebook because, of course, it's Facebook that had the data in its possession, and it's Facebook that chose to disclose the data to a third party. So it's not sufficient for Facebook to say, you know, now at this moment, well, you know, we've contacted the party, and it's now on them to disclose the data. That's not the way data protection works. Facebook bears the responsibility for the consequences of its decision to release that data. I don't think there's any other way to understand this.
Well, let's focus then on how the data was used and the very real possibility that this data tipped the elections for Trump in those three key states of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. The personal data that the Facebook had of both the Facebook user and their friends, my understanding is that it was used in a political context by finding out who these people were, how they think, what they talk about, what they read, and what they listen to. And then once you have that information, then you can micro-target information to them that a lot of which was fake news or amplified by Russian bots. That's my understanding.
Well, that's correct. And I think if you, you know, trace the history, of course, of advertising, you understand the particular risk of the use of personal data in this way. It's not simply a general form of fake news, which we might more precisely call propaganda or misinformation. It's actually a form of personalized propaganda or misinformation that's developed precisely to influence the opinions and the votes of particular individuals. I mean, it's hard to imagine a single greater threat to democratic decision-making. And that's apparently what transpired on the Facebook platform in 2016. So the full dimensions, I think, are being better understood now, and the role of companies like Cambridge Analytica and Facebook and others are also better understood. The critical question is what will be done to prevent this from happening again in the future. And here I think we do need to talk seriously about the various types of reform that are necessary and the legislation that's being considered in Washington to prevent the manipulation of voter opinions as likely occurred during the 2016 election.
Well, when we last spoke, we had a conversation with Jonathan Taplin, who had written a book, Move Fast and Break Things, which is sort of basically exposing the enormous monopoly power of Facebook and Microsoft, Apple, and Google. And in that conversation, it was largely about this phenomenon known as surveillance capitalism. And my understanding is that Jonathan Taplin will be on 60 Minutes in a couple of weeks talking about this. It seems like it's finally getting some attention, isn't it? The very nature of the power of these big five companies, it's gone under the radar. But this revelation that our elections may have been tipped surreptitiously by the use of a Facebook platform and by the lack of rigor and responsibility on the part of Facebook in protecting personal data. It feels like this may explode this story wide open. What's your sense?
Well, I think that's correct. I mean, I think there is underlying all of these discussions, you know, a fundamental question, which is simply this. I mean, can information monopoly coexist with democracy? And it's not at all clear that the answer is yes. I think this is part of the point that is explored in such books as forthcoming by Shoshana Zuboff, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. And the point that Professor Zuboff makes in her book is that capitalism and democracy have been able to coexist because there have been limitations on economic systems established through systems of democratic governance. Now, when those systems of democratic governance begin to break down, which we may have, in fact, seen during the 2016 election, then we actually have a very serious problem, one that is, you know, not obviously solved through political means if those systems are no longer functional.
Well, just in closing, in an interview with The Guardian, Christopher Wiley explains that to get Stephen Bannon involved in setting up Cambridge Analytica, they essentially made him into their first test case on how to psychometrically profile someone and warp their perceptions of what the company was trying to do. That essentially became the model for how to warp Americans' perception of politics and make them believe that they were at the center of a culture war and needed to get skin in the game by getting behind Donald Trump.
Well, it is. And as I said, you know, it's not obviously the first time that there's been a form of political, advertising to try to influence, obviously, the opinions of voters. But I think the scale and scope in this instance clearly is unprecedented. And I think those are the types of issues that we're trying to confront now, is to understand, in fact, how to manage these new systems that create such enormous opportunities for misuse and abuse of democratic decision-making.
Well, Mark Rotenberg, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's very nice speaking with you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Rotenberg, the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University's Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. He has served on several national and international advisory panels, including the Expert Panel on Cryptography Policy and Computer Security at the OECD and the Legal Experts on Cyberspace Law at UNESCO, and he chairs the ABA Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.